This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Starobin, and welcome to America and Beyond the New Books Network. My guest today is Catherine Marsh, who is the award-winning author of books for children and young adults, including The Lost Year, Nowhere Boy, The Night Tourist, and her newest book, The Myth of Monsters, Medusa. Catherine is a former journalist and managing editor of The New Republic, and she lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband, two children, two cats, rabbit, an assortment of exotic pets. Welcome to America and Beyond, Catherine.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Or Kate, however you prefer to be
Kate
called.
Kate is fine too.
Kate is fine too. So how did you wade into, well, two-part question, children's literature, but maybe more specifically this particular book, The Myth of Monsters, Medusa?
So I always loved Greek mythology when I was a kid. I was a big reader, and I had the Dolores Book of Greek Myths when I was quite small. And I remember just really enjoying that whole universe. And one of the things that I kind of even picked up from an early age was that it was definitely the female characters who often had some tough roles and were often blamed for trouble, including Pandora and Medusa. And so that was something where I was thinking a little bit about that actually when I was living in Belgium. I lived in Belgium for 3 years, and that's where I wrote my book, Nowhere Boy. Mm-hmm. And after I finished that book, I started to think a little bit of about this. Partly it was the Me Too movement was starting. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking a little bit about how so many of these Greek mythological monsters are female. Not all of them, but a majority, I would say.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of some of the work that's come out, you know, in the last 5 years. For example, Circe, and, you know, Song of Achilles, and some of these books that are the Madeline Miller books that are reimagining the myths from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And we know Emily Wilson has done a new translation of some of these stories with a sort of eye toward rooting out some of the misogyny and sort of things that have come into it from Western scholarship. So I was thinking about all those things, and I realized I wanted to tell a Medusa story, but I also wanted to challenge some of these ideas about women and girls that are embedded in the traditional versions of these myths. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I started the idea. The book, as all my books do, went through many, many iterations. And as I tried to figure out, you know, how old my character was and where it would be set and what the sort of whole premise was.
Oh, really? Is that, yeah. I wondered about that. Like, so many iterations.
Many, and that's something I always talk to kids about when I go to school, because, you know, it's, we all see literature in its final form, and it can be very deceptive. It's an illusion. You know, you don't see all the work, and you know this as well as I do as an editor, all the work that goes into it and all the different drafts. So I try to highlight that so kids realize that one of the things I like to say is there are no such thing as good and bad writers, because we all kind of struggle with first drafts, and it's the rewriting, right? That's the old saw, but it is the rewriting that where the story sort of comes to life.
Yeah. Well, we could take a small digression, because that does prompt the question whether kids in this age of, you know, social media, and, you know, as an aside, there's this new big book out by Jonathan Haidt, which argues for, if I'm getting this right, basically banning smartphones, social media from all schools, and even, I think, encouraging parents to do so up until a certain age. But my question is whether you think that in children and writing, you know, how has the age that we're living in affected their desire to write in the kind of way that we're talking about, and their ability to, in the end, write well?
That's a great question. I mean, I feel that in the 20 years I've been writing for young people, there has been a noticeable change in reading stamina and metabolism, the sort of metabolism in which we take in information. It's much faster for all of us. Mm-hmm. And I think our attention spans are shorter. So in that sense, I think that the old sort of conception of, you know, the craft of writing, where you slowly and laboriously put something together, is not as familiar to this generation as it might have been to a previous one. But it's also, I think, very instinctive for young people to want to rush through things. And I remember doing that even myself, and not to date myself, but when I was in middle school in that age, there were no, you know, there's obviously no internet, and computers were not really the way we were writing by hand and everything.
Well, can we say what decade we're talking about?
Yes. So I grew up in the 80s. So in the 80s, you know, I was still writing things. I remember doing reports in cursive longhand and getting the whiteout out and all
of
that.
Yeah, I did too. I'm older than you. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Whiteout. I only recently actually kind of migrated away from whiteout. I'm not even sure it's still available.
Yeah, I know. It feels like something of the last century now. But because of all those things, I mean, I still remember even then feeling like I should be able to scribble something out and turn it in, and it should be pretty good. And so I think that is also a natural kind of thought, you know, that you can just instantly create something and it's great. But I think it's become even more of a challenge to sort of, to have kids understand that process of revision and that process.
Yeah. Well, do they write on their tablets or some electronic device, or do they write on some form of paper?
I mean, it really depends where you are. My children went to school in Belgium for 3 years, and that was from 2015 to 2018. They went to local Belgian schools, and it was interesting because they did not have computers in school at all.
Really?
They had chalkboards, and they did cursive handwriting. So it was much more like my childhood. And then when we came back here, it was all whiteboards, and it was much more digital, and has only become so, you know, more so post-pandemic. And now, of course, there's AI, which is a whole other kettle of fish.
Let's not be right.
We don't have to go there.
Maybe
I mean,
later. Yeah, I don't understand enough about AI to ask you a smart question about it.
But I think all of this does sort of change the way that kids read and write.
Sure.
And so, you know, that is something that I'm conscious of as an author, and have even been sort of trying to adapt myself to in some ways, you know, over the last few books.
Yeah. Well, we could pick up on that, but let's go back to Medusa and tell me about your heroine, Ava, who, you know, really carries the book from beginning to end. I mean, she carries along her friends, her brother, even right. almost literally her mother. So right, she's right, a great right. character. I mean, where does Ava come from?
So I had been just thinking about how many adventure books are written with male protagonists, because when I started out doing this, there was this kind of unspoken rule that if you were going to write a big commercial series, you needed to have a boy leading it.
Really?
And the reason why, the sort of, again, a sort of unspoken but known reason why, was because there was this gendered idea that a boy would only read books with boy heroes, whereas girls had been acculturated to read about both boy heroes, and they were fine with that as yeah. well as girls. And I really wanted to challenge that somewhat by having this book led by a female protagonist, but also having it be a kind of adventure series with a kind of commercial idea. And Ava is a seventh grader at a school in America. And she is in a very familiar place, I think, to a lot of middle schoolers, which is that her friend group has kind of dissolved. Her two best friends have decided they've gotten into boys and into being popular, and she's left out. She also is very antagonized. And this was actually something I talked to kids about, because so many of them have experienced this, where she's in class, and the teacher asks a question, and she very dutifully raises her hand, and a boy in the class shouts out the answer and is not, you know, punished or anything. And she's so frustrated. And I think most women, and some men too, have had that experience, where, you know, they feel like they're playing by the rules and they're still not sort of getting the attention, right?
Yeah. Well, my experience, it was usually that person was usually a boy. But there were a lot of boys, and I tended to be one of them, who just kind of like thought that this person was showing off. So like, right. it just pushed me. I'm kind of a contrarian, just kind of pushed me instinctively. I don't think I had any idea what I was at that point, but it pushed me into the other. Yeah. You go ahead, you know?
Right. I mean, it's like we talk about section guy, right? That's an idea that.
There you go. Bill Clinton.
Right. You know, or
first
yeah,
in his
exactly.
class.
Right. And somebody who's like that. And those people do tend to be male, in my experience.
Absolutely.
And you're absolutely right. Like, different kids will, you know, feel differently about whether that is just roll your eyes, or you feel kind of robbed by that person.
Yeah, well, suck up.
You know, I think Ava does feel a little bit robbed, and her anger, and this book is really about female anger, and so her anger comes to the fore, and she loses her temper, and this boy freezes.
Owen.
That is the beginning of where she realizes that something is amiss, and that she may have some sort of power. But her mother very much encourages her to, you know, control that. And she is sent to a school that, I'm not giving too much away here, but is for the descendants of the Greek mythological monsters. Wanted to sort of challenge also these ideas of who's the monster. It is in Venice, the Academia. And I love Venice. It's one of my favorite cities.
Good to hear.
So that's why I set it there. I thought it was a really just a very atmospheric, fun place to set a story. So she goes there to the Accademia del Forte, which is the Olympian school for the descendants of the mythological monsters, and is really taught to control herself. That is the sort of, the school wants these kids not to use their powers. So that is the premise of the book. And for me, it's a way to really explore, how women are often taught to kind of keep their feelings to themselves and not to draw attention, not to, project themselves into the situation. So all of those things are what I kind of set out to explore.
And a sort of subtle aspect of this that may not be obvious is that there are women who are complicit in this system of control, as you describe it, which in a way includes her mom, as well as teachers at the school. So you're not sketching a kind of purely sort of binary picture here.
Thank you for saying that. That's absolutely right. I mean, it's also about the ways in which some of these cultural mores become kind of embedded in you. And that was something I was thinking about a lot as a mother and a daughter, the ways in which you also, there's a lot of desire to protect the women in your life. And sometimes protection equates with telling them to, you know, not be them, their true selves. And so I think that that's something that's relevant even outside of the, you know, discussion of gender.
Yeah. And in the case of her mother, it seemed like it stemmed from a sense of inward fear of herself.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, that is something also that I wanted to explore is the fear, you know, because I have a daughter who's actually 13. She's very similar to the age of Ava. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot about that because I do feel very protective and it's a very hard time to be, a teenager right now.
Yeah. Well, and I always.
Think always, but particularly I think for girls with all of the, you know, bring back it. This background of social media, and some of the things that are happening on social media to girls are really important. And so there's a definite protective drive that I feel as a mother, but at the same time, I don't want to protect to the point of in some way, you know, limiting her and her sort of, you know, ability to be in the world.
Right.
And so that was something that was also a push-pull that I wanted in the book as well.
Well, naturally, I wondered, you know, knowing that you're a parent, a mother, and with a daughter, whether how much that might influence or somehow seep into character and character development.
Absolutely. I mean, all my books are written from some sort of, you know, kids always ask, where do you get your ideas?
And right.
I get them from discomfort and fears and things that frighten me. Mm-hmm. And I always think that's the best material. It's like, you don't go to the things that you're sure of. You go to the things that you're sort of feeling like you need to explore, even if it's, you know, scary. So yes, that's where I sort of, that I definitely plumbed some of that when I wrote the book.
Yeah. Well, self-exploration is also a theme that informs Ava's character because her arc in a way embraces this kind of trajectory of self-exploration. I mean, she's not initially altogether happy about her superpower.
That's correct. Yeah. She herself feels like it is, it's a negative kind of thing, that it's something that people will see her as monstrous and see it as a negative quality. And I think sometimes women worry about that in girls about, well, if they speak up and they say something, they want to be liked. And this idea of saying something that may be true, but may make other people judge you is very difficult. And I still struggle with that. I think a lot of women still, we like to be, you know, I think, you know, I feel like I often want to say yes when maybe I don't want to say yes, but I feel like I should because I don't want to make people unhappy. And so Ava is struggling with some of those feelings. And the whole premise gives me a way as an author to kind of explore that.
And also the fact that she has a sort of more concentrated dose of a superpower than her brother, who is sort of the star, you know, and used to being so in academics and so forth. Is that of some appeal, you know, kind of competitive appeal to her, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's also something that I have two children. I am an only child myself, so I don't have that dynamic. I didn't live it as a child, but I certainly see it as an adult where kids are sort of comparing themselves to each other in the same family. And I thought it would be interesting also for, you know, the way these rules work of how you inherit your ancestry is that some kids, even in the same family, siblings can have different sort of amounts of monstrousness,
right.
monstrosity. And so, and they can also have different powers. And I thought that was really fun. And I love playing with that because you could have a very mild power that is not really going to, you know, shake the world, or you could have a bigger one. And what I also sort of felt was fun was taking the male character and giving him a power, which I don't know if I should reveal here just as a spoiler.
For me, it's fine. It's up to you, really. You're the author. I mean,
Jax,
you know.
I'll say it then. Jax is a healer, and Medusa's blood, you know, has a healing power, and he's inherited the healing power, which is, you know, is a milder, like more kind of, it certainly has an active component, but it's not as active as sort of.
Right. They're children of Medusa. That I think we have to say that.
Right. And so, so he has a different, so he's in a different capacity of like healing people. He's not in the sort of warrior role, and she is. And that's kind of a reverse gendered kind of stereotype. And I really enjoyed doing that and having that be the sort of, and also having them switch roles, because oftentimes in families, when kids decide to be one, when one kid is going to be the, you know, the kid who gets great grades, the other kid tries to define themselves against that.
Yeah. And of course.
So it's kind of fun that way too.
Oh yeah. No, I witnessed that. It might be sort of almost like competitive non-achievement or something, like who can get to the bottom quickest. It's like, I'm thinking like, no, this is not the way we want it, but it's somehow that dynamic asserts itself. So not to pin you down too much, but do you have a perspective about monsters and mythical powers and whether they actually exist?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm an English major. I was an English major at Yale, and that's where I kind of, you know, I loved literature and poetry and all of this. And I think that my pleasure that I take in this is less as the, you know, that there is like true powers than the sort of metaphor of these powers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for me, it's just fun thinking about,
that
you know,
sounds very Harold Bloom like somehow. Or...
Well, I did study with him.
There you go.
But I just think it's also fun. I mean, every kid loves to have that conversation of which superpower would you have if you could have a superpower.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved playing with the idea of all the different superpowers that you could extrapolate from these monsters, because we often see them as their powers in the service of some sort of, you know, bad behavior. But like, well, what if you took some of these powers and used them for good behavior, you know? And that's kind of what was fun. And also thinking about which powers I wanted to play with as a writer. For example, transformation, which I think, you know, one of the characters has a power of being able to transform herself that she can't completely control yet. And I also like that as a metaphor for adolescence of like your powers are maybe not completely under your control. So she in this book transforms almost without being able, and she can't control it initially. It just suddenly her hair changes and her eyes change and this happens. And I think that's a very, something that resonates with kids at this age because they are themselves, you know, transforming through adolescence in ways that they don't always like or want. But I love playing with that because I also think of transformation as a very female power, right? Like women really change a lot. Their bodies change. There's like a lot of things that happen, you know, as a woman and a girl. And so I love playing with that character. And so in terms of like, do I think that really those powers really exist? Yeah, they kind of do, right? I mean, they do.
Well, if you think they do, then in a way, I mean, it gets kind of metaphysical, not to channel like a Joseph Campbell or somebody, but, you know, the myths seem to reflect something fairly deep, you know, archetypal. And so I think my own view is our culture will just always generate myths.
Yes, that's right. And I think these myths, You know, one of the things that I also kind of wanted to do is I do think that the myths, you know, there's a movement in some ways to move away from these, you know, very male, very white, very European centric stories. But I also think that there's a way to adapt them.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of something I wanted to have kids think about is like, well, you know, you might see read these stories and not feel that you're represented here or not feel like it's sort of your world. But there are ways to adapt them and take that essential humanity that's in them and kind of, you know, use it, but put it in your own.
Yeah, that was my takeaway. I felt like right. You were in many ways validating myth, but you were recasting this particular one, which suggests that you're not, your goal is not the annihilation of myth.
No, it's not. And it's, I mean, I'm very much to bring back, you know, Bloom again. I mean, I think there are only so many stories that are out there and we retell them and change them and adapt them and make them ours.
Yeah.
But it's the question of who gets to tell that history
right.
that I think is really relevant right now to all these discussions going on and you know, who gets to give their side of the story. And so this was a way for me to kind of take some of these characters and give them their sides of the story.
Right. Although at the end, you do seem to push back a little bit about at the idea of the monsters. I, you know, Ava tells her mom, we're not monsters, mom, we're goddesses, smart, fearless, and beautiful.
Yes. And I think monsters, I mean, this is the wonderful thing about the Greek myths is that everyone's related, right?
Yeah, that's for
all,
sure.
They're all very inbred group of people.
Oh, yes.
Creatures. And so, you know, that was something that was really interesting to sort of play with and create my own kind of lineage there for Medusa and for Ava. But I do think that gods and monsters are in some ways matters of perspective and that they also, you know, it's really fun to think about, well, what are these monsters representing and what are the possibilities for them too? And I had a lot of fun thinking about that for Medusa and who she is in my sort of alternative narrative.
Yeah. So when you think about her, did it come to you like in images at all, like visually?
Not so much. I was thinking about it more in terms of, that's a great question because I don't think of myself as a particularly visual thinker. I think more in terms of feelings. Does
right.
that make sense? So, you know, I thought a little, I was definitely thinking about how she felt,
yeah.
you know, about where that anger might've been from, what it represents, you know, those type of questions, like how the male gaze affects how we see her, all of mm-hmm. those type of things. And then also because I write for kids, I'm always thinking about pacing and plot and making sure that it's entertaining. And I love that challenge because, you know, I would be in academia or, you know, I've worked in journalism as well doing nonfiction, you know,
right.
sort of policy and politics. And that's a whole different thing. But
yeah.
what I love so much about children's literature is that these guys, these kids are they get bored fast. And I love that. I love that you have to keep the narrative as the central driving engine.
Right.
You know?
How much did it inhabit like your subconscious or your dreams or something? I mean, did it infiltrate like even when you were not even particularly wanting to think about the story you were in developing?
A lot of work for me gets done as a writer when I'm not writing.
Right.
And I think that's actually something where I feel that any authors, my advice is often to be kind to yourself when you're stuck, because you'll do a lot of that work sometimes when you're just napping or walking or
right.
getting away from the project.
Yeah.
I do think that
patting the dog, that's what you know, that's
right.
my usual go-to.
There is a subconscious, you know, process of working out some of these knots
right.
and ideas, which I think definitely takes place. I can't think of any specific dreams that I had. I mean, I also do some background reading. I, you know, I certainly write whole things that don't make it in just to sort of play with ideas and,
sure.
you know, try things out.
But it doesn't feel like, compulsive. I mean, some writers are just, they really just sound like they're in a grip of a compulsion, and you almost feel bad for them. It has to come out before they can somehow get on with the rest of their lives.
Right. I mean, this book was also, I wrote this book. I had started it and then I put it down to write The Lost Year, which, is a historical fiction book about the Ukrainian famine of 1932-33. And that book had a lot of personal resonance for me and was really deep and dark and hard in a way that Medusa suddenly felt like play. And so that was kind of nice, even though it's dealing with a similar, not it's not dissimilar, even though they're very different books, it's still that question of who gets to tell the story, because The Lost Year is about the who kind of gets to tell the story of people's memories and about disinformation and hidden history. And so this is not totally removed from Medusa, where Ava and her friends are kind of on a quest to figure out a sort of a piece of history that's been suppressed.
Oh, absolutely. They want to excavate. They're kind of like investigative reporters in a way. I felt that. I mean, looking for clues and being relentless, and fearless. I mean, all qualities that we can associate with a real investigative reporter, or in a way, foreign correspondent, perhaps. Now, I also felt that there was a pedagogical objective that was at work, which you, I think, have really, in a way, kind of described yourself. So my larger question about that is whether with children's literature, that has in itself a kind of tradition, and does it work?
That's a great question. Yes, and absolutely. There's always been, going back to children's literature in America in the Victorian era and before, it was often pedagogical, often had a moral kind of, and going back to Grimm, if you look at the way the Grimm brothers rewrote fairy tales, it was very much with a moral perspective. I like to think that my books introduce some of these ideas that are challenging ideas. But that the reader is kind of being taken along for a story and can kind of, can experience it as opposed to be told it. And I think the difference for me with children's literature that's like more qualitative than others is it that the story does the work as opposed to the author in a way. Like the author has, I obviously have my worldview and my thoughts and all of that, but that the story is where you go along for the ride and then you sort of take away something from it,
Well, are
right?
children readers hungry for a moral?
I think children reader ch like kids this age, middle grade readers are interested in how the world works and how to in experiencing it and questioning it and their own feelings. So something like the feeling of Ava being stuck in the class and having some boy raise his hand and sort of dominate and her getting angry. I found talking to kids, that's a really familiar feeling, right? That feeling. And so to sort of explore that and what would happen if you had the power to kind of stop that, is something that they like to think about. And it raises the question of, well, like, how do I use my voice? What are the ways in which I can use my voice for good? What are the challenges of using your voice in this world? What are the dangers? How do our parents feel about these things? How does that affect the parent-child dynamic? The idea that your parents aren't perfect is really like something that emerges in these middle grade years where you stop sort of venerating your parents and you see them as mortals, so to speak.
Yes, I've
And so I think all of that is part of the experience of growing up. It's a real innocence to experience kind of time from, I mean, I specialize in writing for kids that are basically, this book is for 8 to 12, but like a lot of my books are 10 to 14. So anywhere in that sort of middle grade area, I think is where you're starting to kind of seek your own moral universe, right? And you're trying to kind of play out these ideas of, you know, who am I and how do I, you know, how do I project myself and how do I project myself apart from my family, which is why so many books also get rid of the parents in some way.
Yeah, that's
it's that
right.
Fantasy of a certain type of liberation, which I think is harder for kids today, frankly, because kids are less independent. They're more, you know, the pandemic really locked people down with their families. You know, I think there's a certain protectiveness that parents have. Some of it, you know, based on real concerns, some of it based on fear.
Right.
But all of this has made, I think, kids crave that kind of exploration. And that's what children's literature is there for, is to kind of explore these questions.
Right. Well, does it feel like with children's literature that this story can be, this book can be inserted into sort of a larger direction in which children's literature is going, or not really?
I mean, I think that children's literature in terms of the direction it's going in, it is getting more diverse, which is a very positive thing in my mind, because it has been a kind of, you know, focusing on certain groups and experiences, and now there's a lot more out there. I do think that there is some very pedantic children's literature right now, and that will not necessarily have the staying power. I do think that, like, I try to always have characters who are not black and white, and although there are kind of heroes and villains, but you know, there's a character in Medusa I'm thinking of that I don't want to exactly tell about, just because that would be a bit of a spoiler, who turns out to have a little more complicated backstory that at least explains some of their actions, and their actions are not entirely as evil as one suspects from the get-go. And so that's always of interest to me. I always find that really interesting. In The Lost Year, that's a story where I really explore that even further. There's a parent-child relationship in which the parent really is, mm-hmm, in many ways a bad person, but is very loving of his child.
Right.
How do you grapple with that? And so I do find that those are really interesting narratives for kids. And when things are very black and white, then it's like a little more, but some kids also crave that. Like you have to, I feel like development is really different kid to kid.
Sure.
And I've seen this even with my own kids. They have very different tastes in the level of darkness and the level of complexity and the level of, you know, what their genre tastes are. And so there are going to be kids who want a kind of more simple moral story, and there are going to be kids who want a little bit more complexity. But we do live in very polarized times right now.
Yeah.
As you know, where I think the stories that have a lot of complexity, I think kids need those stories too.
There's social, sort of the children's literature equivalent of social justice warriors that have a pedantic objective in mind. And to kind of flip that around a little bit, are there folks sort of on the expressly conservative side, let's say social conservative, or perhaps imbued with Christian values or something of that nature, who have their own kind of thrust in this direction, where, you know, I guess a reflection of our polarization, where both sides want to drive home what they see as a important, you know, truth, you know, for children to grasp?
Yes, I would say so. But I also would say that my biggest concern, well, I have a couple concerns with what's going on in the world right now with kids and literature, but in that specific area, my concern is the book banning, which has really had a huge effect on the types of books that are making their way into various, you know, parts of the country, libraries and schools, and have, you know, I know many authors who have been impacted by that,
right,
in terms of the types of stories they're trying to tell. And that, to me, especially having just written a previous book about Stalinism, is very concerning, and propaganda, and this idea that we need to police books. It also irritates me, frankly, because I don't think kids are reading enough. And I think, you know, I want books in my kids' hands. I want books. I want all books, and I want them. And, you know, I think back about the type of reader I was.
The physical book? Do you want like the physical book as opposed to something on a tablet?
It can be an electronic book or an audio book, whatever. But I just mean, I want kids to be engaged with narrative and stories in a form that's, you know, books or, you know, audiobooks are fine too. Some kids, you know, respond better to that. But I really am concerned about, you know, the fact that sitting or reading a whole story or book is something that we're not, I feel a panic over, that a lot of kids are not reading that much outside of school and are not even reading that much in school. And so that's sort of where my concern, I think that we can get a little bit distracted by, you know, by some of these other things, but I do find the book banning to be troublesome for me.
Right. Well, it's part of the challenge with the reading that we're such a visual culture because we're such a visual culture, does that in some way warp, you know, what kids expect to see on the page when they're reading?
I mean, I do think kids have become more visual because of everything with screens, and that's why graphic novels have become particularly popular. But I also think graphic novels are stories, and that my hope is, like, I always talk about this as a diet. Like, I have no problem with graphic novels if they're part of a diet that includes books that are of different types of, you know, genres that are not graphic novels. If you're reading graphic novels and you never go and read any other type of book, to me, that is problematic, because I think that there's a lot that is really, you know, rich and wonderful about, you know, all the other books that are out there, both in the past and, you know, right now, contemporary literature that are, you know, just words.
Right.
But I think we also have to be realistic and about the fact that, you know, there are these changes afoot.
Sure.
We felt them as adults. You know, I think that all of our attention spans have been affected. But I think there's something about whole stories. And that's what I want to talk about more than, you know, medium almost, is like a whole story is really important and not just a passage. And this is something that I wrote about for The Atlantic, about passage reading. And we've done a lot through Common Core to focus on getting kids to read passages. And I feel like stories are about emotional arcs, and they're much bigger and they're much more personal. And so that's sort of where I want the focus to be. I hope kids read cool stories.
I understand. Well, I know writers often don't like to be discussing what they're in the midst of, but can I ask you what is next or might be next?
Well, I just am doing the edits right now on a sequel to the first Myth of Monsters book, which is called The God's Revenge. And it is going back to the same world and the same characters and the academia and the whole school there, dealing with another, particularly another character who ends up imperiled. So I'm finishing that right now.
Okay.
So be out next year in 2025.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. And good luck with that. And thanks, Kate, for being on America and Beyond with me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.